The three C's, clans, cliques, and clubs. Everyone has probably enjoyed the belongingness and social support that membership provides. Throughout history, organized groups have waged war and influenced everything from local customs to the division of wealth and property. But when does loyalty to the group begin to interfere with individual freedom, and at worst, the very stability of society itself? And how do we live in a democracy and balance both individual and group needs and pressures? I'm Susan Wilson, and on today's Central Standard, we'll talk about how our modern society was shaped by ancient forms of social organization, otherwise known as clans, and debate the balance between individual freedom and group loyalty. How do we understand the group and individual forces in our lives and society? That's coming up after the news. Rugged individualism has long been associated with being American. We're a self-reliant bunch, small business owners and farmers alike. We raise nuclear families that live in single-family homes, and we celebrate our individual achievements in work, business, and higher education. But would we be as free to pursue an individual path to life, liberty, and happiness if it were not for a stable government, a system of government that provides for the collective good? Without a healthy and stable state, some argue that humans revert back to forms of organization that focus on strong group, family, and religious ties. Loyalty to clans, an ancient group of social organization, helps provide social order and safety. Unchecked, however, clans can degenerate into violence and all-out war. So we ask today, is too much individualism a threat to a healthy modern society? On the other hand, have we forgotten the important social and psychological benefits and threats of clans? This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Today we explore the advantages and disadvantages of the clan versus the state, and the implications of both on modern society, world trouble spots, and developing nations. Joining us today is Mark Weiner, author of the book, The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom. Welcome to Central Standard, Mark. How are you this morning?
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be on the show.
So let's kind of start at the beginning. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I spent a semester teaching American constitutional law in northern Iceland, where, very improbably, there's a little law school nestled snug up against the Arctic Circle. And while I was there teaching about American constitutional law, I was also researching the history of medieval Icelandic law. And medieval Iceland was a society governed by a group of highly decentralized, what we would call clan organizations, that were spread out across the island. And then I was thinking at the same time about a third society, or a third and a fourth, and that was contemporary Afghanistan and Iraq, where many of my students either had been soldiers or were currently fighting. And at a certain point, thinking about the similarities between the clan organization of medieval Iceland, the clan organization and the tribal organization of Iraq and Afghanistan, and modern American constitutionalism, a kind of electric current jumped between all those societies and brought them all together. And I thought, how could I think about the dynamics of clan organizations and its relation to modern states more generally? And that's where the book came from.
So let's talk clans. The word actually comes from a Gaelic root. What does a clan mean?
A clan you can think of as a subset of a tribe. It's an extended family or kinship group. And the rule of the clan is a name that I give to forms of social and legal organization that are structured primarily on the basis of kinship or extended family membership, or a type of collective principle that looks a great deal like that. Now, these forms of social and legal organization exist along a spectrum from fully stateless tribal societies. Think of a place like Somalia or the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, through what I call clanism, a dominant form of social organization, especially in the Middle East, to even in the heart of contemporary liberal democracies where a type of clan organization exists where the writ of the state fails to run. Think about many American inner cities, right, where gang behavior resembles, in some respects, the type of organizational relationships that you see in ancient tribal societies.
Now, you point out that wherever government is weak, that's when you see the rise of clans and their strength really manifest itself.
Precisely right. So in the absence of a strong, robust, healthy state that's capable of vindicating both the public interest at large and therefore the interests of individual citizens as such, that is, as individual persons, other types of organizations fill the vacuum of power and maintain social and legal order. And the dominant such organization is the clan group, the extended kinship group. And what's striking about the way that these groups maintain social and legal order is that they're based on principles of collectivism and collective identity that the modern state supersedes.
So let's talk about, you know, you're talking about the rule of the clan. So I'll turn that around. How do clans rule?
So clans, that's a great question. So, and I like the inversion. So clans rule on the basis of principles that are focused primarily on the stability, the health, the maintenance of the group, as opposed to the maintenance of individual freedom. So let me give you two examples of legal principles that are associated with the rule of the clan. Collective property ownership. We're used to in the United States we're used to the ability of individuals to hold title to land as individual persons and to be able to dispose of that land, to do with that land what they will. Under the rule of the clan, collective property ownership is a dominant legal principle. That is, individuals have only a temporary, or what we call usufruct interest in land, and instead the land is owned by a collective group. Or here's another example. In modern liberal societies like the United States, in our criminal law, if you do the crime, you do the time, right? You are held individually responsible for the wrongs that you commit. Under the rule of the clan, that's not the case. If you do the crime, your cousin, under principles of collective liability that are at the heart of the blood feud, your cousin can be punished by a rival clan for the crime that you commit, right? So both in forms of property holding and in criminal law, under the rule of the clan, a principle of collectivism, of group fellow feeling, trumps the individualized focus of modern state power.
Now, on the other hand, you talk about the modern liberal society, and that is an important structure to hold things together in the absence of these small ancient groups. So how are you defining modern liberal society?
Yeah, I should say that I'm not thinking about, when I use the term liberal, I'm not thinking in partisan political terms, Democrats versus Republicans. You can think of liberal as a term that's given to those who hold to a political philosophy that grew out of the 19th century that emphasizes individual rights, democratic governance, and general social tolerance. And the point that I make in the book is that those values of individual rights, social tolerance, democratic governance, of course, but especially individualism, the values that are at the center of American social and cultural life, those are in a way historically inconceivable in the absence of strong, healthy, robust, transparent government structures. It's government that makes individualism ultimately possible, because without government, other types of social organizations emerge to fill that power vacuum and we get the rule of the clan.
So in a way, you're saying democratic government and individualism have to go hand in hand.
Absolutely. Without democratic government, the opposite of government. We often describe somehow this world in which government doesn't exist as a world of absolute individual freedom, often described as the market. But in fact, the opposite of government is not a world of individual freedom. The opposite of government is a world of collective organization that squelches individualism in the service of the group.
So you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and we're talking today about individualism versus the group and the modern state with Mark Weiner, author of the book The Rule of the Klan. Now, we ask you, audience, is there too much individualism in our society today, and is it a threat? And how and where do you draw the line? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2828, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, I guess a follow-up question. There's a lot of people, my conservative friends especially, who talk about big government, and we have too much government. So how does the whole concept of too much government relate to your idea of a modern democratic state as being important to individual freedom?
My conservative friends asked me that as well, and I think that's a great question. So my argument is not that government shouldn't be efficient, or that government shouldn't exist within, say, in the United States, a fully federalized system in which states have very strong authority over regulating day-to-day affairs. And it's not that government should be the rule of the Klan is prevented, is kept in check by good government, not by bad government. If government indeed is ineffective at doing the job that it needs to do, then government itself is delegitimized. And a delegitimate government is as great a threat to individual freedom as the rule of the Klan, in part because when government is delegitimized, it allows those Klan forces in our social and political life to assert authority in the absence or in the face of state power. So absolutely, I think there's nothing in – this is not a partisan political book. It's not an argument in favor of a Democratic or a Republican vision of government. But it is an argument in favor of the importance of government generally. And it tries to set some broad historical and comparative terms in which we can understand just why it is that we need government to be effective.
Now, you know, back to individualism, you know, we have free market economics, et cetera, et cetera. But is there a point when too much individualism also hurts our modern state? You know, there was a book someone wrote a few years ago, Bowling Alone, the fact that we are so individual that we don't even have the connectivity in our social fabric that we need anymore. So what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. Two thoughts. The first is that I should say I see the greatest threat in modern liberal democracies like the United States not as being too much individualism. I think that it's often said that in books like Bowling Alone, which is a terrific book, that the American life threatens, as Alexis de Tocqueville once said, to isolate each individual person entirely within the solitude of their own heart. Right? There's too much individualism. There's too much self-focus in our society. And that may be true from a social, cultural, and moral perspective. But from a political and legal perspective, I think, in fact, the opposite concern should be at the forefront of our minds, and that is with the withering of or the delegitimization of government, that other collective forms of social organization will rise to the fore and squelch the very individualism that we hold dear. But I do think at the same time that if liberal societies are unable to provide for the same type of collective fellow feeling that we find provided so well in clan or tribal societies, the social solidarity, the psychological security that comes from being a member of a group, the sense of social justice. If we're unable to provide for that, then liberal societies collapse into their own hollow core. So what we have to learn, what liberal democracies have to learn about the future of individual freedom from the rule of the clan, is not simply that we need a strong government that's capable of keeping the forces of clanism in check, but instead that we also need to do a better job in providing the solidaristic goods that clan societies provide so well.
Because do you think maybe that Americans, we overstate our individualism? I mean, we do have many examples in our society of clans, of clubs, of fraternal organizations, etc. So don't we coexist in our society anyway today with some form of clans?
You know, also an excellent observation. So there are two interesting things you could say about that. The first is that we, American society, is filled, fortunately, with a very robust civil society. So we have looking at American society is looking like looking at the Milky Way, and scattered across its sky are all of these solidaristic organizations that we typically call clubs. Now, the difference between a clan and a club is that while both provide very important collective goods and a sense of group membership, clubs allow for absolutely free individual exit. You can leave your club anytime you like. You don't like one club, you join another, terrific. That's not the case under the rule of the clan. Under the rule of the clan in traditional clan or tribal societies, you're born into that solidaristic group and you never leave it, and you never can, and you always have to rely on it. That's not true in the liberal civil society that provides in the United States many of the same excellent goods that clan societies do. And please.
So when we think about, and you bring this up in your book, groups like the mafia or gangs, those are closer to clans, of course, than they are clubs, because you really can't exit them very easily.
Precisely so. You join the gang and you're there for life. And indeed, that's why often gang membership is associated with the with getting, for instance, a tattoo, right? That marks you forever as a member of that group. But that's not so if you're a member of the Elks Club. It's not so if you're a member of the local Episcopalian Church. It's not the case if you're a member of, how about the McDougal Clan's annual gathering on the lawn of the clan chief, right? The even your membership in the most traditional of clan groups of 17th century Scotland today is subject entirely to your voluntary will. And yet we have this attraction to join those types of groups, and that's ever present in liberal society. And that's why we find throughout the culture of liberal democratic societies like the United States, movies, books, films, comic books that celebrate this ancient way of living, this clan or tribal form of living, and valorize it, at least as a cultural matter. Think of, say, James Cameron's Avatar. Right? Mm-hmm. These are a film like that celebrates clan life. Why? Because when we make a transition from the rule of the clan to modern liberal democracies, we gain a whole lot. We gain a government that's capable of both vindicating the public interest and individual rights. And yet we lose something as well. And movies like that attempt to recapture it.
So Kansas City, I mean, the Avatar Blue Clan is certainly one of them. But do any of you have family roots in ancient or modern clans? Tell us what they are by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2828. Or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is KCURCST. And we have a caller today. Richard, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi.
How are you? And your question?
Yes. Actually, I come from the Farquharson clan of Central Scotland, but that's beside the point. I have a different question for the host. In regards to the last election and over the, I would say the past 3 or 4 decades, corporate structures have grown to become extremely powerful. And to the extent that often the leadership of those structures would prefer a less strong government outreach. And I'm interested in knowing if the host has ever thought about or researched how corporate structures have kind of a clan orientation, and that if you work outside that structure or if you pose a threat to that structure, that it decreases individual human choice. Or so I'm not sure if my question's clear, but
and it sounds like you're asking too that if you break the rules of that culture, you pay a price.
Exactly. That and that those cultures, as they become increasingly monopolistic and choose to diminish the influence of a central government, if that poses a threat to the central government, which in turn poses a threat to the liberal individual freedoms.
So, Mark, what do you think about our caller's question?
Well, I think Richard's question is fantastic. Bingo. And this indeed is an issue that I talk about in the final chapter of my book. In the absence of strong government oversight and effective regulation of corporate structures, there's a natural inbuilt tendency to monopolize, to gather power into that corporate collective group. And indeed, corporations pose, I think, at the same time that we can support a vibrant market society as essential to not only economic development but individual liberties, we have to be terribly careful to ensure that in the face of weakening support for economic oversight and regulation of corporate structures, that these groups don't become essentially the new clans of today. And indeed, the bottom line to which every corporation has to look is essentially a collectivizing principle that diminishes the status of each individual within the organization in relation to the economic needs of the group. So I think Richard is 100% right on, and it's corporate groups as well as gangs that threaten to bring a new form of the rule of the clan into our lives if we don't take the lesson from the ancient form of social organization that I describe in my book, which is that only a robust, healthy government can ultimately protect individual freedoms.
Well, you know, the other aspect of Richard's question that's very intriguing is, you know, it seems like larger and larger groups of corporations have been allowed to come together. And, you know, the small businessman in many cities and towns going out of business as a result. So, you know, does this start to limit individual freedom to have your own business, to make a living on your own?
I think, again, this is a great insight and something I touch on very briefly also in the final chapter. The ever-increasing concentration of economic power in major corporations that are now transcending the power of individual national governments poses a challenge not simply to individual freedom to the extent that they take over the regulatory and social ordering principles that typically states take on, but also to the extent that they prevent individuals from acting on their own, as, for instance, you mentioned small businessmen, in the economic realm. So, absolutely.
So we have Carrie that just wrote in, society is a group of people that live within a system in harmony, not individuals separated by selfish desires. But then she asks, or is this just my unrealistic utopian belief?
That's a great question. Thanks for your question, Carrie. So Carrie says that society is a collection of people brought together, not simply individuals acting out of their own selfish interests. And that's true. That's what a society ought to be. But such a society of, for instance, Americans or citizens of Kansas all coming together and acting as a group is possible only because of the strong, effective government that treats people as that collectivity, as Americans, as citizens of Kansas. And in the absence of government, individuals instead are treated as members of their clans. And we want to see Carrie's vision of society as a common group of individuals, a common group of individuals prevail rather than society being constituted by a series of clans and their members.
Well, Kansas City, we're really interested in you joining in to our conversation this morning. What do you think about this idea of the individual versus the group? Call us by call us using the number 816-235-2888 or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to continue our discussion about modern society and the roles of clans, tribes, clubs, etc., maintaining and destabilizing the social order around the world. Central Standard returns in just a minute. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Susan Wilson, and my guest today is Mark Weiner, author of The Rule of the Clan, What Ancient Forms of Social Organization Reveal About the Future of Individual Freedom. So, Mark, we have on our line a caller who has some firsthand experience with being in a clan. We're going to take his call. Patrick, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Patrick.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience and your question.
First of all, let me say that it's a complicated matter here trying to define such a sociocultural issue here in 1 hour and 30 minutes. I think that what your guest is trying to explain is really very complicated. I come from a place where clan and tribe is the way we are defined. And coming to the United States, I find individual liberties trumping what group thing. And it created some problems for me trying to adjust in this country. I think also that your guest is making a simplistic mistake trying to equate clan with clubs and trying to talk about liberal democracy as trumping clan and tribal relationships. You cannot leave your clan and you cannot leave your tribe because it's not something you got into by choice. You were born in it, and that's where you live, and that's where you get your identification from. Just like someone from the United States is described as an American, if you come from a tribal society, your tribe defines you. Am I making sense?
Yeah. So, Mark, what do you think about Patrick's comment here?
Oh, absolutely. I agree 100%. And if I'm not clear about that, let me make it clear now that under the rule of the clan, what's most significant is that one cannot leave one's clan, precisely as Patrick says. In liberal democracies, however, you can think of the transition from the rule of the clan to modern liberal democracies, the same type of transition that Patrick made in his immigration to the United States is a transition from clan to club. That is, clubs are like clans in that they provide solidaristic benefits, but they are wholly unlike clans in precisely the way that Patrick points out, because you can leave them voluntarily at any time. There's a transition from kinship to social networks as the foundational principle of society. I'd be interested in knowing where Patrick is from, if he's willing to share.
I am from Côte d'Ivoire.
Ah, very nice. Ivory Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's terrific, Patrick. And it's very interesting that Patrick notes that the transition that he accomplished within his own lifetime, that it takes many societies hundreds of years to undergo, right, was a very difficult one. And it's precisely to make that adjustment easier for people like Patrick that I think it's essential that citizens of modern liberal democracies need to understand the rule of the clan, to understand just where people like Patrick are coming from, and to enable that extraordinary transition that people make in a single lifetime that societies take centuries to undergo.
So we have another caller, Matt, on the line. Good morning, Matt. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I don't think my experience can compare in any way to the gentleman who just called. That's pretty fascinating.
Wasn't it?
That's really, and kind of, and I think he has experienced a spectrum of that most people don't, you know. And
so what's your question today?
Well, I had a question about the discussion today is a very interesting one, because it kind of prompts me to kind of revisit the contrast between Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the definition of human nature. And you have Hobbes, who sees people as basically violent and always going to live in a state of war, and Rousseau is describing the human person as really only happy in a natural state. And these have tremendous, I think, implications with regard to what you're talking about here, and also tremendous implications for the type of politics and the type of government that we'll create here in the United States. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
Good question.
Yeah, terrific question. Thank you. I should say that the previous caller, Patrick, though he presented really an extraordinary story and a very helpful contribution to our discussion, our current caller, I'm sure, also has had experiences from a different angle, that is, from the perspective of a citizen born into a modern liberal democracy, that are equally important contributions to our discussion, in part because there is no society on earth that lacks the historical experience of the rule of the clan. This is a universal phenomena that we all share at some point in our histories. But as for the debate between Hobbes and Rousseau, I'm not a political philosopher, but I will say this, that the natural tendency of humans in the absence of authority is not to live as free individuals. The natural tendency instead is to live in collective kinship groups or groups that look a great deal like ancient clans. And it's only by supporting the strong and effective government that can keep the very deep impulse of the rule of the clan at bay, that we can, in fact, maintain individual freedom. You can think of the impulse toward the rule of the clan as deeply rooted in our nature as our psychological and sexual drives. And understanding, appreciating just how deep that impulse is as not only a personal but also a sociological matter, I think, is essential for being able to construct the type of government that we really want that enables the type of society we value.
Now, when you talk about the depth of those ties, how does that help us understand what goes on in some of the hot spots around the world, the Middle East, Syria? How does this whole concept of clan play a role in either stabilizing or destabilizing those parts of the world?
Mm-hmm. I think you can think in regards to your question as all people in the United States who are committed to principles of individualism and liberal democratic life, liberty under government and law, as having a common cause with and being part of a common struggle with liberals and others who are supportive of individual freedom in places like, well, in throughout the Middle East, in Central Asia, wherever it is in the world where government is weak, other types of clan-like organizations rise to the fore. Whether it's in the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan, or in the half-states that you find throughout the Middle East, in which modern state power has been co-opted by clans or clan-like groups in the service of their collective interests. So there's this very deep, personally, psychologically, and socially, sociologically, drive toward collective organization. And the struggles of Democrats in the Middle East in this respect is not unlike the struggles of those committed to principles of democratic government and individualism here in the United States.
But what about that, though, gives rise to, and I mean, and I'm not just talking about the Middle East, but, you know, as we think about some of these other organizations like gangs and the mafia, how do these deep ties give rise to the violence that we see?
Oh, how do they give rise to the violence? So this is an interesting question. I mean, because the deep ties, the organizations arise from deep desires for solidarity and social order. But why is it that these collective organizations give rise to violence? Ah, that's a very interesting story that we could talk about at length. It arises in part from the principles of collective liability that we talked about at the very beginning of the show that serve as the fundamental ideals of criminal law in those societies. So under the rule of the clan, if an individual engages in some form of wrongdoing against a member of another clan group, then any member of that individual's own extended family, we're talking about extended rather than nuclear families, any member of that individual's extended family, it can be under the principles of blood feud retribution that govern the rule of the clan, can be injured or killed or held responsible for the individual's wrongdoing in exchange. Now, that principle, the principle of collective liability and blood feud, has done a great job for hundreds of years in maintaining relative stability and social harmony in these societies. But now we're facing a new problem. And the problem is what you can characterize as a legal technological mismatch. So the finely calibrated exchange of reciprocal violence that's essential for the legal institution of the blood feud to operate effectively, is that finely calibrated violence, an eye for an eye, a brother for a brother, a cousin for a cousin, is capable of being meted out if you're using the type of weaponry that was created in the Neolithic era when the legal institution of the blood feud was also created. But if the dominant weapons that you have in your society are automatic firearms that can spray bullets into a crowd or RPGs or what have you, then very quickly the principles of the blood feud can spiral the violence out of control and destabilize an entire region.
A chilling thought. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson, and my guest is Mark Weiner, author of the book The Rule of the Klan. We're discussing Klans and their influence on past and modern society. Kansas City, what do you think about this concept of Klans? Do you prefer to be independent, or do you think that being a part of a group is really important? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Now, we have a question on Facebook, Mark. Bill asks us, I wonder if the anthropological impulses of the Klan explain the cover-up of horrible behaviors at Penn State, Enron, and within some hierarchies of the Catholic Church. What do you think about Bill's question?
That's very interesting. Bill, I'm going to have to think about that some more, but I will say this. When we're members of a collective group and when our social value, when our individual worth in the world is dependent on that collective group, then people will do really a very great deal to ensure that that group maintains a reputation for being honorable. You can imagine the clubs with which we're affiliated in liberal democratic societies in that respect as being similar to the clans to which listeners like Patrick belonged in their home countries, as maintaining not only principles of collective liability under the blood feud, but also principles of collective honor and collective shame. And people will do really a very great deal to maintain the honor of the group to which they belong if that honor reflects, that collective honor reflects back on the individuals themselves and their ability to work their will in the world. Now, just imagine that you belong to a group from which you not only derive honor, social status, and value, as we might from our colleges or clubs or churches, but also you couldn't leave that group ever. And if you think about that scenario, then you have the rule of the Klan.
So we have another question from Ross. Ross, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard. And you have a question. You're from KCK. Ross? Well, maybe we lost Ross.
I could follow. Please, Susan.
Yeah, I was going to ask, but in terms of the cover-up, and you mentioned shame-based societies, is that the root of why, you know, some of these cover-ups that are that Bill asks about occur to avoid shame primarily, or are there other forces at play there?
Well, I wouldn't want to the excellent examples that Bill brought up really span so many very different types of organizations, and I wouldn't want to speak about the particulars of, say, the cover-up of abuse within the Catholic Church or in Penn State or elsewhere in the examples that, or Enron he mentioned, but certainly in the types of groups that are important to solidaristic feeling, that not only individual shame is at play, but the long-term viability of the group, even in an economic sense. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I also, Susan, if I could, wanted to return to the chilling scenario that we had been talking about earlier. That is the possibility that principles of collective liability and blood feud can destabilize an entire region because there's currently a mismatch between an ancient form of legal technology, namely the blood feud, and our contemporary military technology. And that is that societies can overcome these challenges. And if you think about the difference between the most recent election in Kenya and the previous election and the extraordinary job that many Kenyan liberals, especially members of the middle class, using social media technology and advancing the principle of one Kenya over the individual clan and tribal affiliations of previous years. If you think about that example, you see that, in fact, clan societies like the one from which Patrick came can make this extraordinary historical transition in overcome the threats that now exist so strongly to their social stability.
So a positive note that clans can transform over time and use a common goal or a common good as a way of moving together and not destabilize things.
Absolutely. So in this is a historical task in which people from a whole variety of perspectives can join. Whether you're a merchant who is advancing principles of individual rights or a lawyer dedicated to the neutral professional ideals of your profession, or an artist or a writer who's engaged in constructing the great common ideals of a society out of its collectivist clan past. These are all, every person can have a role in their society in helping that society overcome the rule of the clan. And people in the United States can help them.
So we have time for one more question, I think. Good morning, Guadalupe from St. Joseph, Missouri. You have a question.
Well, actually a comment, and it's just to do with the in how primal the Klan, the association and its parameters, how primitive, but how quickly we return to that primitiveness out of nowhere to go or just in strength and numbers. And I'm bringing in the examples of prison gangs and gangs there where, you know, you indeed have the blood feud element in place. But I just wanted to make a comment that it affects all aspects of society and that is prevalent and very, very glue for, I think, a lot of the gang activity and the prison gang organizations. Thank you.
Guadalupe, thanks for your question, and I absolutely agree, and I really appreciate your perspective. The prison analogy and the gang analogy is really important in highlighting the ways that sociologically, in the absence of an effective common organization that treats individuals as individuals, by treating individuals as members of a truly common public, we can revert. We can develop forms of organization that look a great deal like ancient clans. And so there is this constant push against liberal democratic society. And if we allow fissures in liberal democratic society to develop, they can quickly be filled with the force of the rule of the clan, precisely as Guadalupe describes.
Now, Jeff writes in, and he says, I'm a member of a tribe called Veterans, and our tribe is very important to us. And he says, Mark, can you speak about clans like these, things that build a clan like a clan-like mentality, such as the armed forces?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jeff, first I want to thank you for your service to the country. I think the armed forces are very interesting intermediary groups in that, especially in, well, classically in the Marines, but it's true in the other branches as well, principles of collective honor and shame are held very strongly. You're a member of this group of the armed forces, but now that you're a veteran, you're no longer subject to military law. Right? So in a way, the strength of your affiliation with the armed forces today is really a matter entirely of your own individual choice. You can choose to affiliate more or less strongly with your local veterans groups. So while you were in the armed forces, indeed, you were in a way a member of a clan that looked a great deal like the ancient clans that I talk about in the book. Now that you're a veteran, you're a member of a liberal democratic society like any other, and your military affiliation is more like that of a club.
So, Mark, as we end up here today, in a nutshell, how would you sum up what we should take away from this whole discussion about the rule of the Klan?
Well, I think that the rule of the Klan shows us the importance of maintaining a healthy, robust, and effective government to protect individual freedom, because without a healthy government for various personal and sociological reasons, the rule of the Klan arises to maintain social and legal order and treats individuals not as individual citizens, members of a common public, but instead as members of a collective group, decreasing their individual agency and autonomy.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Mark Weiner, for the discussion today. And Mark is author of the book Rule of the Klan, as well as all of the other callers who participated in our discussion and wrote in on Facebook and Twitter. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we explore local distilleries and the unique challenges they face in providing their potent product. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Up to Date is next with a closer look at God Particle. Plus, a former death row inmate talks about his exoneration through DNA. I'm Susan Wilson, signing off, and this is Central Standard.